Today we have a special guest. We've been doing a series on the Cold War, and the last episode was on President John F. Kennedy, and no series on President Kennedy is complete without discussing his wife, our First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, one of the most, if not the most iconic First Lady of all time. We have author Paul Brandis, who just wrote a book. It was newly published. I'm looking at the Amazon date. It says August 25th. So it's fresh off the printer, and it should be on bookstalls now. The book is called Jackie, Her Transformation from First Lady to Jackie O. And so we're very pleased to have Mr. Brandis on our show. So welcome. Hope you're having a great day.
Thank you. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. When we look at the life of Jacqueline Kennedy, there's just something about the Kennedy family. There's something about her specifically that continues to fascinate the American public. And so what basically led you to write this book?
Well, exactly for the reason that you just indicated. She is a fascinating person, really one of the most iconic first ladies in American history. And even though she has been gone for nearly 30 years now, she continues to loom large in the popular culture. And so that's why I did it. And I focused on this particular period between her two marriages. We're talking about, obviously, the period between November 1963, when President Kennedy was killed, and October 68, when she married Aristotle Onassis, a five-year period. Because most books on Jackie tend to not focus on this period. They look at her through her White House years or her marriage to Onassis or her later years working in the publishing industry, that kind of thing. But there is not a lot on the 5 years in between her two marriages. So that's what I focused on. It's an incredible period for her. I mean, growth and change, and obviously one of great difficulty, too, but just an amazing period.
Right. And it's fascinating. You start the book talking about, well, comparing President Kennedy with Aristotle Onassis, the two men in her life that she married. And they make for a very fascinating contrast. But usually they're seen as kind of, they're basically bookends of your book. And, you know, it starts off with the Kennedy assassination and then gets to Mr. Onassis. But what interested me is that Aristotle Onassis seemed to figure in her life even when she was married to President Kennedy. So could you talk about how the Kennedys, including Jacqueline Kennedy, got to know Mr. Onassis and just who he was?
Well, people were shocked when they got married, but if they knew the full story of the relationship between Jackie and Aristotle Onassis, I think perhaps they wouldn't be quite so shocked. Aristotle Onassis, the wealthiest, most powerful man of the 20th century, his wealth in 2020 terms, if he were alive today, would be many, many, many billions of dollars. He's just extraordinarily wealthy and powerful. He owned his own airline and a tanker fleet that just transported oil around the world. And he knew everybody and was just a consummate deal maker, that kind of thing, just extraordinarily powerful and connected. And so with someone like that, it was almost inevitable that the Kennedys, who obviously were powerful and connected in their own way, it was almost inevitable that they would meet. And what people don't seem to know, Richard, is that the Kennedys and Onassis actually met way back in the early 1950s, long before John F. Kennedy was elected president, of course. And they met at, well, a couple of stories about when they first met. Some people seem to think that Jackie and Onassis met at a dinner party in Georgetown. Other people tend to think that they met actually on in Monaco when they went to a dinner party on Onassis's yacht. He owned most of Monaco, by the way, most of the real estate there. He basically ran that municipality, he and Prince Rainier, I suppose. And John F. Kennedy, the Kennedys were vacationing on the south of France, and Onassis heard about this. And, you know, Onassis knew everybody, of course, and Winston Churchill was one of his closest friends. Churchill spent long periods staying on Onassis's yacht, and the Kennedys happened to be vacationing in south of France, and Onassis heard about this, and he had heard that JFK, who was then a senator, wanted to meet Churchill, so he arranged a dinner party, and that, according to some, is where they first met. So can you imagine the dinner party? You've got Aristotle Onassis, Winston Churchill, John F. Kennedy, and Jacqueline Kennedy. What a dinner party that was. So some people think that is where they first met. So Jackie and Ari actually knew each other long before they got married in 1968.
Right. And it's fascinating because Onassis, who subsequently, for people that didn't live during that time, they remember him as Jacqueline Kennedy's husband, second husband, but he has a very interesting life story on his own. He basically had pretty humble beginnings and overcame that to become one of the richest people who ever lived, basically.
Well, that's true. He was born with a nothing. He was completely self-made man. He was a ruthless, shrewd businessman, and he built his way up, no question about it. He was one of the 20th century's shrewdest businessmen, no question about it. And along the way, of course, and he did it not just because he was brilliant from a business standpoint, but he was also incredibly charming. He could just charm the pants off you during a business deal. He would skin you alive in that business deal, but he would do so while being charming. He was attentive and obviously appealed to women like Jackie and all sorts of other women that he had his way with. He spoke several languages. He could talk about art and poetry and literature, all of these things. Women loved that. And the fact that, of course, he had a boatload of money didn't hurt either.
Right. And Jacqueline Kennedy visited him in 1963, before the assassination.
Well, that's right. After, in August of 63, President and Mrs. Kennedy lost a child, Patrick Bouvier Kennedy. He died after 2 days because of a respiratory ailment, and it sent both Kennedys into this deep depression. And President Kennedy decided that Jackie needed to get away and recharge, and so he allowed her to go on a cruise with Onassis in the Mediterranean. So off she went, and she was gone for a couple of weeks, and they had a great time. And it was really the first time they had seen each other in about a decade. So they rekindled their friendship, and that's all it was at the time, just a friendship. But so that's sort of how they reconnected and got to know each other again. And then just a month after that, of course, President Kennedy was assassinated. I should mention also that Onassis is kind of a soap opera. He was having an affair with Jackie's sister, Lee. So after Patrick Kennedy died in August 63, Lee arranged for Jackie to take this sort of restorative trip on Onassis's yacht. So they were there in the Mediterranean for a couple of weeks. And again, this was just a month before President Kennedy was killed. And after the assassination, Lee, again, this is Jackie's sister, she called Onassis and said, "Can you come to Washington?" So it's amazing that on the very weekend of the president's assassination, Onassis was in the White House itself, staying right upstairs.
Yeah, that's incredible. And at that time, he was with Lee. Is that right?
He was with Lee. He was also with Maria Callas, who was the famed opera singer. And there were other women sort of who were in and out of his life. But at that point, those were the two principal women, Maria Callas and Lee, again, who was a Jackie's sister.
Right. And you talk about the link between the trip and the assassination. And it sounded there was a line that you had written or quoted about maybe Jackie feeling guilty about traveling to see Onassis and then going to Dallas, going to Texas with President Kennedy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, when she came back to Washington, it was on October the 17th. She was very grateful that she had been given the opportunity to go. And so her husband, the president, kind of felt like he was in a position to ask her for a favor. And he did. And he said, look, I'm going on this campaign trip to Texas in late November. Why don't you join me? It'd be great if you went along. And he knew that she would be very popular. The women would love her and that kind of thing. And when it was announced that she would be going to Texas, it was huge. She never went on campaign trips with her husband. Even in the 1960 campaign, she didn't really travel very much because she was pregnant with John Jr. And since the 1960 election, she had never been west of the Mississippi. She had never been to Texas, period, in her life. So now it was announced she was doing all of those things, going on a campaign trip with her husband to Texas in late November. And that is how she wound up in that car in Dallas on the day when the president was assassinated. Again, just an amazing story.
Right. And it's very interesting. I think, well, one question I was going to have was, what did President Kennedy think of Aristotle Onassis, as far as we know?
Well, he was leery of Onassis because Onassis, again, he was seen as sort of a shady businessman, kind of a rogue wheeler dealer kind of thing. He had actually been arrested briefly in the United States in the 1950s. It didn't amount to anything, but he had some that legal run-in. And Jackie went to Greece in 1961, and the Kennedys actually forbid her from crossing paths with him for those reasons. That was in 1961. So it was kind of interesting that 2 years later, she did see him, in fact, stayed on his yacht just 2 years later because he felt, you know, she needed to get away and needed some R&R after the death of Patrick. But they were very ambivalent about Onassis, really tried to keep him away from Jackie. And so again, it's really amazing that that literally the weekend of the assassination, as the president's body was laying in the East Room of the White House, here's Aristotle Onassis, who they had tried to keep away from Jackie, and he's right there with her.
Right. Now, of course, we have the assassination. It changes her life. And one thing I kept reminding myself as I was reading about, you know, reading your book, was that during this time, I mean, she was widowed at the age of 34. So essentially the time that you cover in her book, she's in her 30s. And, right. You know, being someone who's, you know, I'm in my mid to late 30s. And so thinking of the incredible burden that she had and having to grieve so publicly and in a sense really lead the country in its grief during the funeral and just being so present during that weekend. It's an incredible thing. She must have been just such a strong person to have done that.
Well, the assassination really, I mean, obviously changed everything. Prior to that, she was seen incorrectly. I think she was seen as sort of, you know, very aloof and above it all and, you know, a clothes horse and someone who went shopping all the time and that kind of thing. Now, it is true that she was a clothes horse and she did like to shop and all of that. But being aloof, she was actually, I think shyness was probably more of a reason. And also, she was extremely protective of her children. She guarded the privacy of Caroline and most easily the most important thing to her. So for that reason, she avoided the press, and she avoided the press, and she was tagged, in kind of some unpleasant ways. But for her, it was just this desire for privacy and to protect her children. So that was sort of the pre-assassination image. And then Dallas changed all of that. There was this enormous amount of sympathy that obviously went out to Mrs. Kennedy. And the way that she handled herself the weekend of the assassination, her regal bearing, her stoic demeanor, the fact that she kept her dignity and her head held high in the most incredibly difficult of circumstances, it really forever changed the way that people saw her. And it really changed her from what was just a first lady with the shopping and all of that. It changed her into and elevated her into really just an iconic figure. And she stayed like that really until she married Onassis, and that sort of knocked her off her pedestal. But she later kind of reclaimed that image later in life.
Right. And there are a few quotes that you put in your book that I think really stand out. One quote, and this is when her husband was still, President Kennedy was still alive, and she wrote that without him, without Jack, her life would have been a wasteland. And then after his death, there's several very sad quotes. There's one where she said that, I consider my life is over, and I will spend the rest of it waiting for it to really be over. And again, you know, hearing a 34-year-old say this was heartbreaking. And then there's another quote where she says, quote, I should have known he was magic all along. I did know it, but I should have guessed it would not last. I should have known it was asking too much to dream that I might grow old with him and see our children grow up. So you really get the sense of the grief that she bore during that time. And you write about she blamed herself for not saving his life and even that she was suicidal. And could you talk about that and just what you discovered about that period during her life?
Well, it was really ridiculous for her to blame herself for her husband's death. I could name 20 other things that were, even more of a reason for that. But people seem to forget that it happened so quickly. It was over just in a matter of seconds, really, about 6 seconds. And she spent that first terrible winter. She would replay those 6 or 7 seconds over and over again in her mind. Oh, if I had only known, I would have pulled him down to safety, that kind of thing. If she thought the first gunshot was a motorcycle backfire, there were motorcycles surrounding them, police motorcycles surrounding them in the motorcade. Nevertheless, she was just racked with guilt over that. She said, I've heard that gun go off 10,000 times. She had endless nightmares about it. She began to drink heavily. She cried all the time, day and night. It was a horrible, horrible period for her. People don't really understand just how horrible it was because, again, she was very private. She guarded her privacy. She didn't really want anyone to know how difficult it was for her. But yeah, it was so bad for her that May of 64, April and May of 64, she seriously considered suicide. She confessed to a priest, and she thought she really could do it. Were it not for her children, Caroline and John, God only knows what would have happened. She seriously thought about it, and she said the kids would be better off staying with Bobby, Robert Kennedy, her brother-in-law, and Ethel Kennedy. She actually thought what would happen to them. And in the end, I think that's what really prevented her from really, really actually trying to do anything about it. But it was so bad for her that she actually considered that. And again, most Americans don't know anything about this because she was so protective of her privacy. She didn't really tell anybody about this. It was just, just a horrible, horrible period for her.
Right. And you wrote that she lived after the White House, she lived in Georgetown, and it basically became kind of unsustainable because of tourists would go and they climb the trees, and basically she couldn't find privacy there during this terrible time.
Well, she was worried about her privacy even in the White House, which is an 18-acre complex surrounded by a tall fence and this kind of thing. So imagine how nervous she was living in this house on N Street in Georgetown, which was didn't have a fence. It was only just maybe 20, 25, 30 yards from the street, that kind of thing. There was a slimmed down security presence. She only had a couple of guards with her and that kind of thing. So if she was nervous in the White House, just imagine how she felt now. And that combined with the fact that all of a sudden everybody wanted to know what she was doing. How was Jackie doing? What was she up to? So tour companies began to run tour buses down N Street, which is a pretty narrow street in Georgetown. And these tourists would get out of the bus, the cameras wrapped around their neck, and they would hang out there for hours. They'd have picnics, and some would climb trees, and one person even stole the numbers off the house and that kind of thing. It was extraordinarily intrusive. She said she couldn't even change her clothes without closing all the curtains because people could look in. It was horrible for her. So it was more than just her lack of privacy. But again, her husband had just been assassinated. She had legitimate security concerns as well, not just for herself, but for her children. She felt like she was a prisoner in her own home.
Right, right. Very claustrophobic existence, it sounds like.
Extremely.
Yeah. Now, two very interesting people that were in her life during this time, her brother-in-law, Robert Kennedy. And here are two people probably the most grief-stricken by the assassination. And then also the new president, Lyndon Johnson. And there's some very fascinating phone calls between her and then, you know, the new president, Johnson. Can you talk about her relationship with Bobby and LBJ?
Well, Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson couldn't stand each other. And when I say the word hatred, that is not an exaggeration. They really did detest each other. And here's Jackie in between. Jackie actually got along pretty well with both of them. She and Robert were obviously the principal mourners of the president's murder. And then on the other hand, here's Lyndon Johnson in the White House, and he's trying to be as solicitous and protective of Jackie as he could. He's calling her all the time. How are you doing? And he and Lady Bird were always inviting her to the White House for dinner. And she was offered, anything that she wanted to do. Do you want to be ambassador to France or ambassador to Mexico? Anything you want, you let us know. Well, she didn't want to do anything. She wanted nothing to do with politics. And she liked the Johnsons, but she did not want to go back to the White House, period. It was simply too painful for her. And in the time that she lived in Washington after the assassination, she wound up moving to New York in September of 64. But in those 10 months prior to that, she was being driven around Washington. She told her drivers, do not let me even see the White House. Take, whatever route you have to take. So I can't even look at that building. So there's no way that she would go there for dinner or anything. She couldn't even bear to look at it.
Right, right. So too many memories, obviously, painful memories. Now, it's very interesting when you talk about her move to New York City, because that's where she had already been influential in terms of fashion as First Lady, and she continued to be influential in terms of fashion but in a very different way once she is in New York City. Could you talk about that?
Well, again, everybody watched Jackie, what she wore, what her hair was like. Everything that she did was copied. It was so in the White House, but now when she was a private citizen, perhaps even more so. Everything that she did was just instantly copied. Women wore what she wore. They had her hair done the way she had her hair done. She was at the very top of the A-list in Manhattan. So she was the trend setter. And what she liked about Manhattan was that, well, one, it wasn't Washington. She was not, she married into politics, but she was never a political person. Even though her husband was the president, she didn't really like kind of the rough and tumble world of politics. And so when she moved to New York, all of a sudden she was surrounded with people that she seemed to enjoy more. It was artists and writers and you know, great composers like Leonard Bernstein and those kind of things. So she began to circulate with, again, with people like Bernstein and Andy Warhol and Truman Capote and people like that. She began to enjoy herself immensely. So the move to New York was healthy in a way that it got her out of Washington, which she had grown to detest, but it also opened a lot of doors for her, put her in touch with a lot of new people who kind of energized her. And so she began to change. And while she never got over the assassination, she learned to manage it a little bit better. So the move to New York, rather, was very helpful in that regard. And in terms of what she wore, again, I mentioned all the women wanted to wear what Jackie was wearing. They might not have been able to afford it, but they did their best. And for example, the miniskirt, which was invented in England in 1965, Jackie helped bring the miniskirt to America. She started to wear shorter skirts. Again, we're only talking about a woman, as you say, who's in her mid-30s, very attractive. So she began to wear these shorter skirts, and that really helped miniskirts take off in America. It was largely because of her. She was enormously influential in just all kinds of ways, and fashion was obviously one of those big things.
Right. And one thing I was thinking as I read about her life there, you talk about how essentially she was stalked by paparazzi and by one of the most famous paparazzi, maybe the first great paparazzi of his era, Ron Galella, I think that's his name. And it really struck me. She was kind of the first Princess Diana. When people think paparazzi, they think of Princess Diana. But really, Jackie was kind of one of the first people to really be, you know, just so scrutinized to the point of discomfort.
Well, the word paparazzi only really dates back to about 1960, by the way. And when she moved to New York again, everything she did was watched very closely. And this photographer who you mentioned, Ron Galella, he didn't really take his first picture of her until about 1967, I think. But there was so much interest in her that it became really just an obsession with him that just really covered pretty much the rest of her life. He is still alive today, quite elderly. I think he's around maybe 90 or so, something like that. But she was his meal ticket for a long time. He would lurk outside her apartment on Fifth Avenue and trail her everywhere. And again, given her the security concerns that she always had, she was very worried about this, would wind up going to a court, getting a restraining order against him and that kind of thing. But yeah, she was widely followed and photographed by everybody. She was on the cover. She was on more magazine covers, I would guess, than almost any movie star in the 60s. It was just phenomenal. She would send one of her, you know, maids down to the nearest newsstand just to get some magazines and cigarettes. She was a big chain smoker. And she got a kick out of reading these magazines with her picture on the cover, just seeing how much of it was wrong, and a lot of it was made up and stuff. She got a great kick out of that.
Right, and it's incredible when you wrote that Ron Galella had actually finagled his way into dating Jackie's maid as a way to break into the to get into the inner circle, basically.
Well, this happens after the period of scope that I talk about in the book, but that is true. He wanted to get so close to Jackie that he would, you know, the doorman in her own building wouldn't really talk, but he would bribe doormen in other buildings and that kind of thing. And he actually wound up dating one of Jackie's maids mm-hmm. for a brief period of time. And that came to an abrupt end when Jackie actually saw the two of them together on the street one day. She was fired then and there.
Right.
And well, obviously with a good reason. I mean, that's a huge act of betrayal for her to do that. But again, that's what she did.
Right. So going back to the assassination and the time in the aftermath, one thing you wrote was that it seemed that there were two things that kept her going. The first was her kids and just raising them and giving them the best life that they could have. And the second was defining JFK's legacy for history. And she gave a series of interviews after the assassination. And some of those, the contents of those interviews are still sealed. Could you talk about those, that time and the interviews and what was said and, you know, what she revealed?
Well, there are conflicting forces here, two principal forces that were at odds with each other. The first was that she was desperate to forget the assassination. She just could not get it out of her mind. It was dragging her down, as I mentioned before, with the thoughts of suicide and everything. She was so desperate to get that out of her mind. And yet, at the same time, she was obsessed with protecting her husband's image and you know, turning him into, you know, this again, this iconic, heroic, mythical figure. So she single-handedly got the ball rolling on what is now the Kennedy Museum up in Boston. So she was up to her neck with getting the museum off the ground and the fundraising and, you know, memorializing him and all of that, while she was trying to forget the assassination itself. So these two conflicting forces, she's being pulled in different directions, and that's what she had to deal with.
Right. Now, I remember, so I was 11, I believe, around 11 when Jacqueline Kennedy passed away. And I remember growing up and hearing about her, and it was almost like she was kind of like the national unicorn in that she was mysterious. She wasn't in the news, but when she did, you know, get on the news, when there was a sighting of her, it was huge. And it would be on, you know, the news, it would be on the cover of newspapers or magazines and all that stuff. And there was a very interesting quote where you compare her to Greta Garbo, the legendary actress. And you talk about how she was someone that liked being noticed, but didn't like being, I guess, acknowledged, or didn't like having people interact with her. So it was kind of one of those, she enjoyed the attention, but she didn't want too much attention. Could you talk about that?
Well, she and Greta Garbo had dinner at the White House, President Kennedy. The three of them had dinner 9 days before the assassination. And after that, Garbo sent Jackie just a note of sympathy and that kind of thing. And when Jackie moved to New York the next year, they reconnected, and they actually had a lot in common. Greta Garbo, of course, was one of the biggest movie stars in the 1920s and 30s, and she left it all behind, wanted to get away from Hollywood, which she grew to detest, moved to New York for the anonymity, and she bought this sprawling apartment on the Upper East Side. And it's very similar to what Jackie did. She was sick of Washington, decided to get out and flee. She winds up buying this sprawling apartment on the Upper East Side, and So they actually reconnected in 1964 and would have dinner together and attend small dinner parties together and that sort of thing. And they each liked to go on kind of long, solitary walks around Manhattan where they could be not quite anonymous, but pretty close to it, just because it's the city is so crowded and everything. They could sort of just disappear and melt into the crowd. And they were both very attracted to that kind of philosophy. So Greta Garbo leaves Hollywood, Jackie leaves Washington, pretty much for the same reason. And they reconnected when they were both in Manhattan. And that friendship endured for quite a while.
Right. Now, there are a few incidents that happen that are, some of them are quite heartbreaking and some of them are near tragic that you talk about in the book. One of them is what I thought was a pretty heartbreaking moment where she's picking up her son, John F. Kennedy Jr., and he's being taunted about his father being dead. And then there's another incident where Caroline was basically assaulted. And then another one you talk about where she almost died on in Ireland, it was going for a swim. So could you talk about those specific incidents?
Well, again, she had these enormous security concerns about her children that never went away. I mean, you know, even when Caroline and John were grown up and had families of their own, I mean, she was always the mother who always worried about she was the mama bear who always worried about her cubs. That really never goes away. And there were those were just two examples of kind of the concerns that she had. And those fears were well grounded. In the case of John, it's true. She was walking him home from school one day. It happened to be, I think, the third anniversary of the assassination in 1966. And some of these little boys were taunting John, saying, "Your father's dead, your father's dead." It was, what a horrible moment. Mm-hmm. And John wound up holding on to his mom's hand even tighter as they walked down the street. But just a searing moment, particularly for Jackie, I would think. And then kind of maybe even a scarier situation with Caroline not too long after that. They were walking out of church one spring Sunday, and this crazy woman on the street actually grabbed Caroline, grabbed her by the arm, tried to grab her away, and kept screaming that your father is still alive and your mother is just an evil person and this kind of thing. And fortunately, the Secret Service agents who were with them were able to pull Caroline back to safety and everything. But again, what a terrifying moment, not just for Caroline, but her mother, again, who is deeply worried about the security of her kids. And stories like this obviously justified that concern.
Right. And now we also read about what you wrote about the men in her life after President Kennedy. You talk about Jack Warnecke, I believe that was how you pronounce his name.
Jack Warnecke.
Warnecke, yeah. Right. And Dave Almsme Gore. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but could you talk about them and then how eventually basically Onassis emerged from the pack?
Well, Onassis was sort of always lurking in the shadows. They didn't really date, but they saw each other at social events and small dinner parties and that kind of thing. And so Onassis always called himself the Invisible Man because nobody ever really saw them together. And during this period, again, we're talking about between late 63 and the fall of 68. Jackie obviously could go out with anybody she pleased, most well-known woman in the world and very attractive and wealthy and all of that. And she originally, so she dated widely and had a fair number of relationships. Most were not serious. Most were just kind of social things with men escorting her to the theater or a gallery opening or something like that. But there were a few that were actually quite serious. And one was John Wernicke, who was a very prominent architect in the 50s and 60s. And he actually knew President Kennedy, and he actually wound up designing the grave for President Kennedy at Arlington. Jackie's now buried there as well. And they began a relationship. It was, I think, by all accounts, a sexual relationship that began in the fall of 64, and it really went on until about 1966. And she was also quite close to David Ormsby Gore, who during the Kennedy era was the British ambassador to Washington. And he had actually known JFK way back in the 1940s when JFK was, he lived in England when his father was ambassador and everything. So again, long histories between the Kennedys and these kind of people. And she dated Ormsby Gore after Wernicke, and that was quite serious too. And he actually asked her to marry him, and it was quite difficult for her, and she was quite torn, but ultimately said no. And she said no in, there was a series of letters that the two of them wrote to each other that only became public about 4 or 5 years ago, I think. And in one of those letters, Jackie said that, you know, I can't marry you. I mean, I love you, and I have feelings for you, but I can't really marry you because you remind me too much of my painful past, and I simply can't, I can't deal with it, essentially is what she said. And then she told Ormsby Gore, who by then had joined, he was a member of the House of Lords in British Parliament, so he was also known as Lord Harlech. And she told him that in some ways, I feel like you're my brother. Well, boy, what a tough thing to read from a woman who, you know, who you had asked to marry. So, so those were two relationships that didn't work out, and those I think were the two most serious ones. And there are a few other people that she went out with, but again, during all this time, here's Aristotle Onassis going about his business, and he owned an international airline called Olympic Airways that by now was flying to New York and everything. So he had good reason to be in New York a lot on business. And he had a hotel suite that he maintained at the Pierre Hotel on Fifth Avenue, about 24 blocks below where Jackie lived. So again, socially, they were always seeing each other at dinner parties and that kind of thing. So she had her share of men during the 1960s. Those were the most serious ones.
Right. Now, you describe her marrying Onassis as almost like a liberation for her. What did you mean by that?
Well, she had spent all this time trying to, move beyond the assassination, get the pain of that behind her. She would live with that for the rest of her life. But she never got remarried until Bobby Kennedy was himself assassinated in June of 68. And it was just incomprehensible, not just to the country and the world, but to Jackie in particular. How could there be two Kennedy assassinations in 4.5 years? It's just unbelievable. And again, it simply reignited all of these security concerns that she had, which were certainly legitimate. I mean, her husband was gunned down. Her brother-in-law was gunned down. She had every right to feel scared. And she had had enough. And the murder of Bobby was so jarring for her that she decided that enough was enough. So I think it was Bobby's murder, again, in June of 68, that really convinced her that she needed to make a break completely. And Aristotle Onassis, as we've discussed, he was so wealthy, could give her anything that she wanted. He had his own private airline, his own island in the Mediterranean, on and on and on. She could give him all of the security and privacy that she wanted. Money was not an issue. You know, when she was married into the Kennedy family, The money that she had wasn't really hers. It was all derived from the Kennedys. Onassis essentially gave her almost a blank check to spend whatever she wanted. The joke is she spent so much on clothes and travel and everything. The joke is that he gave her a blank check and she exceeded it. And that caused later strain in their marriage. But in the beginning, he gave her everything that she, not just everything that she wanted, everything she needed. She had huge security concerns after the murder of Bobby. He said, you will be completely safe with me, again, with a private army and just a private airline and just everything you need. So that was extraordinarily appealing to her. And also the fact that they had this history going back years. He was not, he might have been an invisible man, but he was hardly an unknown man. They knew each other quite well. And Onassis also, for a lot of people don't know this also, he was just extraordinarily charming. He was a good listener. And I think I mentioned before, he was quite cultured and sophisticated. Yes, a shrewd shark of a businessman, but also enormously appealing to women in that he was a good listener and extraordinarily attentive. And the fact that he had a bunch of money obviously was, didn't exactly hurt either. But there was so much about him that appealed to Jackie that I think after Bobby was killed, it was almost just a matter of time before they would wind up getting married. In fact, it was only 4 months from the murder to the time when she got remarried.
And there were a lot of reactions to her marrying Onassis. And one of them, probably the, I think, kind of the most memorable one, was one headline said it was like JFK died again. What other reactions? What was the reaction to her marriage?
Well, they were shocked. I mean, the headlines were just vicious and full of betrayal. And again, some of these newspapers and citizens, not just in America, but around the world, they simply could not believe that she was marrying this guy. But again, they didn't really know the history that we've just discussed. I mean, going back, to the early 1950s, they didn't really understand the needs that Jackie had for security and privacy. They just didn't understand what it was like for her. Everybody around her is getting gunned down. At least that's the way that she felt. And nobody could understand that but her. And the other thing I think about this is that I think that Jackie became such an iconic, mythical, idealized woman after the assassination, when she held herself up so well in those days after the assassination. The images of her walking in the streets of Washington and at the funeral and everything, it was just so powerful and iconic that there were people who wanted to always see her like that. They thought, this is the Jackie, this is the way Jackie should always be. And in a way, I think it was sort of a selfish sentiment that there were a lot of people who could not understand what Jackie was going through and did not necessarily want her to live her life on her terms, which she was certainly entitled, as we all are, to live a life on our terms. And that is what she wanted to do. Again, she was only 38, 39 years old in the late 1960s. She had most of her life ahead of her, and yet most people still expected her to keep playing the role of the grieving widow and this kind of thing. She did not want to be that way for the rest of her life. She wanted to get on with her life and not be stuck in November 1963.
Right. Now, she still had her New York apartment. Did she live there throughout the marriage, or was she in Monaco? How did that work?
Well, that was her 1040 Fifth Avenue was her principal residence for the rest of her life. She moved in there in September 64, and that would be her main residence until her final days. She died in that apartment in May 94. Well, she had other homes, of course. She liked a horseback ride, and she had a home in suburban New Jersey that you would go to on weekends. And there was always Hyannisport, of course, the Kennedy home. And President Kennedy had his own house on the compound, and she inherited that. And so she always had that house. And in the meantime, Onassis, of course, he had Asclepios, his island in the Mediterranean. He had a lavish home in Paris. He had suites and hotels in Athens and in Rome and just London. I mean, everywhere, really. So she was always on the go, staying in these lavish places. But when all was said and done, 1040 Fifth Avenue in New York, corner of 85th and 5th, that was her principal residence. And she liked the stability that offered, the security it offered, also because Caroline and John, of course, they grew up there and they were going to school there. And when she got married, of course, they were still just kids. So it was important for them to have a stable base when they went to school. So that was always her principal residence, even when she was married, even in the 7 years that she was married to Aristotle Onassis.
So after writing this book, what surprised you most about her that you maybe didn't know before researching about her?
Well, I think the main thing is, I think the thing that I think impressed me the most was that how everybody knew that she held up so well that weekend after the assassination. But I think the thing that Americans didn't really realize that was the Jackie that had always existed. They'd always seen her incorrectly through this, and again, this prism of being just a clothes horse and all of that. That was the real Jackie, just the very dignified and gracious Jackie. I think people always misunderstood, one, how intelligent she was. She was just extraordinarily intelligent. And two, they misunderstood and underestimated how strong she was. Everything that she endured, I mean, seeing her husband's head was literally blown apart inches from her face. She endured that and moved on. She was incredibly strong, incredibly disciplined, quite intelligent. She spoke multiple languages, was just, she read about a book a day sometimes. She would just devour books. She was incredibly well-educated. She was not one of these, you know, flighty women marrying some rich guy. She was quite accomplished on her own. And I think the fact that she went on after Onassis died in 1975, she at the time, even then, was only in her mid-40s. She went on to have a rather illustrious career in the publishing industry. She obviously didn't need the money, but she felt like she could contribute. So she went to work in that industry and brought out a lot of really amazing books, not just on arts and culture, but interesting figures like even she worked with Michael Jackson, for example, on a book and this kind of thing. She was just enormously well-rounded. And, you know, you've heard the term a Renaissance man that's, attached to certain men. She was a Renaissance woman in every sense of the word. And it's interesting now we hear people talking, sort of comparing other first ladies to her. Every first lady is unique in their own way, but I think she was so unique because she was she was literally a Renaissance woman. And it's interesting that she said if she could have married any president other than John F. Kennedy, who would it have been? And she instantly said Thomas Jefferson, because Jefferson was literally a Renaissance man as well. He had so many things that he was good at and so many varied interests, and he just devoured books like she did, and on and on and on. So I think that was a very revealing answer. So these are, I think, some of the things that surprised me the most.
Well, the book is called Jackie, Her Transformation from First Lady to Jackie O, by Paul Brandis. Paul, we appreciate you coming on the show and telling us about all the research that you did on this book.
Well, I really appreciate it, Richard. Just a great chance to talk, and thank you very much.
This American President is produced by myself, Richard Lim, and Michael Neal. If you like what you've been hearing, you can help us by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to our show. We are a proud partner of Evergreen Podcasts. Check out evergreenpodcasts.com for more shows you might enjoy. I'm Richard Lim. We're back next time with more This American President.
You didn't place too much credence in the movie JFK, did you?
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, it's a fine film. It has one of the best musical scores John Williams ever wrote.
Musicals.
But even Oliver Stone admits that he looks at it as a fiction to fight other fiction is what how he described, or at least justifies it.
I know. My fear is that it's been decades since the assassination. People don't know their history, and they look at that and go, man, that's what happened. And I haven't seen that in a long time, but go back and look, but they should put up like a superimpose on the print of that movie throughout the whole thing, that this is just a work of fiction.
Right, you know? Exactly.
It's not what happened, you know?
History is the greatest adventure story, but does it ever leave you wondering what the women were doing all that time? This is Lori from the Her Half of History podcast, and the answer is that some women were seizing power, or escaping slavery, or spying for their country, or creating artistic masterpieces, while countless others were doing the laundry, getting married, and wondering why their clothes don't have more pockets. If you would like to hear the stories of women doing all of those things, check out Her Half of History at herhalfofhistory.com or wherever you get your podcasts.